cavity derived from their vicious conception by breaking out into biles and scabs. And when kings deny themselves some such necessary power, it is not always, though sometimes, out of ignorance of what is necessary to the office they undertake, but many times out of a hope to recover the same again at their pleasure, wherein they reason not well, because such as will hold them to their promises shall be maintained against them by foreign commonwealths, who in order to the good of their own subjects let slip few occasions to weaken the estate of their neighbours. So was Thomas Becket, Archbishop of Canterbury, supported against Henry II by the Pope, the subjection of ecclesiastics to the Commonwealth having been dispensed with by William the Conqueror at his reception, when he took an oath not to infringe the liberty of the Church. And so were the barons, whose power was by William Rufus, to have their help in transferring the succession from his elder brother to himself, increased to a degree inconsistent with the sovereign power, maintained in their rebellion against King John by the French. Nor does this happen in monarchy only. For whereas the style of the ancient Roman Commonwealth was the Senate and people of Rome, neither Senate nor people pretended to the whole power, which first caused the seditions of Tiberius Gracchus, Caius Gracchus, Lucius Saturninus, and others, and afterwards the wars between the Senate and the people, under Marius and Sylla, and again under Pompey and Caesar, to the extinction of their democracy and the setting up of monarchy. The people of Athens bound themselves but from one only action, which was that no man on pain of death should propound the renewing of the war for the island of Salamis, and yet thereby, if Solon had not cause to be given out he was mad, and afterwards in gesture and habit of a madman, and in verse, propounded it to the people that flocked about him, they had had an enemy perpetually in readiness, even at the gates of their city. Such damage or shifts are all commonwealths forced to, that have their power never so little limited. Private judgment of good and evil. In the second place, I observe the diseases of a commonwealth that proceed from the poison of seditious doctrines, whereof one is that every private man is judge of good and evil actions. This is true in the condition of mere nature, where there are no civil laws, and also under civil government, in such cases as are not determined by the law. But otherwise it is manifest that the measure of good and evil actions is the civil law, and the judge the legislator, who is always representative of the commonwealth. From this false doctrine men are disposed to debate with themselves and dispute the commands of the commonwealth, and afterwards to obey or disobey them as in their private judgments they shall think fit, whereby the commonwealth is distracted and weakened. Erroneous conscience. Another doctrine repugnant to civil society is that whatsoever a man does against his conscience is sin, and it dependeth on the presumption of making himself judge of good and evil. For a man's conscience and his judgment is the same thing, and as the judgment, so also the conscience may be erroneous. Therefore, though he that is subject to no civil law sinneth in all he does against his conscience, because he has no other rule to follow but his own reason, yet it is not so with him that lives in a commonwealth, because the law is the public conscience, by which he hath already undertaken to be guided. Otherwise, in such diversity as there is of private consciences, which are but private opinions, the commonwealth must needs be distracted, and no man dare to obey the sovereign power, further than it shall seem good in his own eyes. Pretence of inspiration. It hath been also commonly taught that faith and sanctity are not to be attained by study and reason, but by supernatural inspiration or infusion. Which granted, I see not why any man should render a reason of his faith, or why every Christian should not be also a prophet, or why any man should take the law of his country rather than his own inspiration for the rule of his action. And thus we fall again in the fault of taking upon us to judge of good and evil, or to make judges of it, such private men as pretend to be supernaturally inspired to the dissolution of all civil government. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by those accidents which guide us into the presence of them that speak to us, which accidents are all contrived by God Almighty, and yet are not supernatural, but only for the great number of them that concur to every effect unobservable. Faith and sanctity are indeed not very frequent, but yet they are not miracles, but brought to pass by education, discipline, correction, and other natural ways by which God worketh them in his elect, at such times as he thinketh fit. And these three opinions, pernicious to peace and government, have in this part of the world proceeded chiefly from the tongues and pens of unlearned divines, who, joining the words of Holy Scripture together, otherwise than is agreeable to reason, do what they can to make men think that sanctity and natural reason cannot stand together. Subjecting the sovereign power to civil laws. A fourth opinion, repugnant to the nature of a commonwealth, is this, that he that hath the sovereign power is subject to the civil laws. It is true that sovereigns are all subject to the laws of nature, because such laws be divine, and cannot by any man or commonwealth be abrogated. But to those laws which the sovereign himself, that is, which the commonwealth maketh, he is not subject. For to be subject to laws is to be subject to the commonwealth, that is, to the sovereign representative, that is, to himself, which is not subjection, but freedom from the laws. Which error, because it setteth the laws above the sovereign, setteth also a judge above him, and a power to punish him, which is to make a new sovereign. And again, for the same reason, a third to punish the second, and so continually without end to the confusion and dissolution of the commonwealth. Attributing of absolute propriety to subjects. A fifth doctrine that tendeth to the dissolution of a commonwealth is that every private man has an absolute propriety in his goods, such as excludeth the right of the sovereign. Every man has indeed a propriety that excludes the right of every other subject, and he has it only from the sovereign power, without the protection whereof every other man should have equal right to the same. But if the right of the sovereign also be excluded, he cannot perform the office they have put him into, which is to defend them both from foreign enemies and from the injuries of one another, and consequently there is no longer a commonwealth. And if the propriety of subjects exclude not the right of the sovereign representative to their goods, much less to their offices of judicature or execution in which they represent the sovereign himself. Dividing of the sovereign power. There is a sixth doctrine, plainly and directly, against the essence of a commonwealth, and it is this, that the sovereign power may be divided. For what is it to divide the power of a commonwealth but to dissolve it? For powers divided mutually destroy each other, and for these doctrines men are chiefly beholden to some of those that, making profession of the laws, endeavour to make them depend upon their own learning, and not upon the legislative power. Imitation of neighbour nations. And as false doctrine, so also oftentimes the example of different government in a neighbouring nation, disposeth men to alteration of the form already settled. So the people of the Jews were stirred up to reject God and to call upon the prophet Samuel for a king after the manner of the nations. So also the lesser cities of Greece were continually disturbed with seditions of the aristocratical and democratical factions, one part of almost every commonwealth desiring to imitate the Lacedaemonians, the other the Athenians, and I doubt not but many men have been contented to see the late troubles in England out of an imitation of the Low Countries, supposing there needed no more to grow rich than to change, as they had done, the form of their government. For the constitution of man's nature is of itself subject to desire novelty. When, therefore, they are provoked to the same, by the neighbourhood also of those that have been enriched by it, it is almost impossible for them not to be content with those that solicit them to change, and love the first beginnings, though they be grieved with the continuance of disorder, like hot bloods that, having gotten the itch, tear themselves with their own nails till they can endure the smart no longer. Imitation of the Greeks and Romans. And as to rebellion in particular against monarchy, one of the most frequent causes of it is the reading of the books of policy and histories of the ancient Greeks and Romans, from which young men and all others that are unprovided of the antidote of solid reason, receiving a strong and delightful impression of the great exploits of war achieved by the conductors of their armies, receive withal a pleasing idea of all they have done besides, and imagine their great prosperity not to have proceeded from the emulation of particular men, but from the virtue of their popular form of government, not considering the frequent seditions and civil wars produced by the imperfection of their policy. From the reading, I say, of such books, men have undertaken to kill their kings, because the Greek and Latin writers, in their books and discourses of policy, make it lawful and laudable for any man so to do, provided, before he do it, he call him tyrant. For they say not regicide, that is, killing a king, but tyrannicide, that is, killing of a tyrant, is lawful. From the same books, they that live under a monarch conceive an opinion that the subjects in a popular commonwealth enjoy liberty, but that in a monarchy they are all slaves. I say, they that live under a monarchy conceive such an opinion, not they that live under a popular government, for they find no such matter. In sum, I cannot imagine how anything can be more prejudicial to a monarchy than the allowing of such books to be publicly read, without present applying such correctives of discreet masters as are fit to take away their venom. Which venom I will not doubt to compare to the biting of a mad dog, which is a disease the physicians call hydrophobia, or fear of water. For as he that is so bitten has a continual torment of thirst, and yet abhorreth water, and is in such an estate as if the poison endeavoured to convert him into a dog, so when a monarchy is once bitten to the quick by those democratical writers that continually snarl at that estate, it wanteth nothing more than a strong monarch, which nevertheless, out of a certain tyrannophobia, or fear of being strongly governed, when they have him, they abhor. The opinion that there be more sovereigns than one in the commonwealth. As there have been doctors that hold there be three souls in a man, so there be also that think there may be more souls, that is, more sovereigns than one in a commonwealth, and set up a supremacy against the sovereignty, canons against laws, and a ghostly authority against the civil, working on men's minds with words and distinctions that of themselves signify nothing, but bewray by their obscurity, that there walketh, as some think, invisibly another kingdom, as it were a kingdom of fairies, in the dark. Now, seeing it is manifest that the civil power and the power of the commonwealth is the same thing, and that supremacy and the power of making canons and granting faculties implieth a commonwealth, it followeth that where one is sovereign, another supreme, where one can make laws and another make canons, there must needs be two commonwealths of one and the same subjects, which is a kingdom divided in itself and cannot stand. For, notwithstanding the insignificant distinction of temporal and ghostly, they are still two kingdoms, and every subject is subject to two masters. For seeing the ghostly power challengeth the right to declare what is sin, it challengeth by consequence to declare what is law, sin being nothing but the transgression of the law. And again, the civil power challenging to declare what is law, every subject must obey two masters, who both will have their commands be observed as law, which is impossible. Or, if it be but one kingdom, either the civil, which is the power of the commonwealth, must be subordinate to the ghostly, and then there is no sovereignty but the ghostly, or the ghostly must be subordinate to the temporal, and then there is no supremacy but the temporal. When, therefore, these two powers oppose one another, the commonwealth cannot but be in great danger of civil war and dissolution. for the civil authority, being more visible and standing in the clearer light of natural reason, cannot choose but draw to it in all times a very considerable part of the people, and the spiritual, though it stand in the darkness of school distinctions and hard words, yet because the fear of darkness and ghosts is greater than other fears, cannot want a party sufficient to trouble, and sometimes to destroy a commonwealth. And this is a disease which not unfitly may be compared to the epilepsy or falling sickness, which the Jews took to be one kind of possession by spirits in the body natural. For as in this disease there is an unnatural spirit or wind in the head that obstructeth the roots of the nerves, and moving them violently, taketh away the motion which naturally they should have from the power of the soul in the brain, and thereby causeth violent and irregular motions, which men call convulsions in the parts, insomuch as he that is seized therewith falleth down sometimes into the water, and sometimes into the fire, as a man deprived of his senses. So also in the body politic, when the spiritual power moveth the members of a commonwealth by the terror of punishments and hope of rewards, which are the nerves of it, otherwise than by the civil power, which is the soul of the commonwealth, they ought to be moved, and by strange and hard words suffocates their understanding. It must needs thereby distract the people, and either overwhelm the commonwealth with oppression, or cast it into the fire of a civil war. Mixed government. Sometimes also in the merely civil government there be more than one soul, as when the power of levying money, which is the nutritive faculty, has depended on a general assembly, the power of conduct and command, which is the motive faculty, on one man, and the power of making laws, which is the rational faculty, on the accidental consent, not only of those two, but also of a third. This endangereth the commonwealth, sometimes for want of consent to good laws, but most often for want of such nourishment as is necessary to life and motion. For although few perceive that such government is not government, but division of the commonwealth into three factions, and call it mixed monarchy, yet the truth is that it is not one independent commonwealth, but three independent factions, nor one representative person, but three. In the kingdom of God there may be three persons independent, without breach of unity in God that reigneth, but where men reign, that be subject to diversity of opinions, it cannot be so. And therefore, if the king bear the person of the people, and the general assembly bear also the person of the people, and another assembly bear the person of a part of the people, they are not one person nor one sovereign, but three persons and three sovereigns. To what disease in the natural body of man I may exactly compare this irregularity of a commonwealth, I know not. But I have seen a man that had another man growing out of his side with a head, arms, breast, and stomach of his own. If he had had another man growing out of his other side, the comparison might then have been exact. Want of money. Hitherto I have named such diseases of a commonwealth as are of the greatest and most present danger. There be other not so great, which nevertheless are not unfit to be observed. At first, the difficulty of raising money for the necessary uses of the commonwealth, especially in the approach of war. This difficulty ariseth from the opinion that every subject hath a propriety in his lands and goods, exclusive of the sovereign's right to the use of the same. From whence it cometh to pass that the sovereign power, which foreseeth the necessities and dangers of the commonwealth, finding the passage of money to the public treasury obstructed by the tenacity of the people, whereas it ought to extend itself to encounter and prevent such dangers in their beginnings, contracteth itself as long as it can, and when it cannot longer, struggles with the people by stratagems of law to obtain little sums, which not sufficing, he is fain at last violently to open the way for present supply, or perish, and being put often to these extremities, at last reduceth the people to their due temper, or else the commonwealth must perish. Insomuch as we may compare this distemper very aptly to an ague, wherein the fleshly parts being congealed or by venomous matter obstructed, the veins which by their natural course empty themselves into the heart are not, as they ought to be, supplied from the arteries, whereby there succeedeth at first a cold contraction and trembling of the limbs, and afterward a hot and strong endeavour of the heart to force a passage for the blood, and before it can do that, contenteth itself with the small refreshments of such things as cool for a time, till, if nature be strong enough, it break at last the contumacy of the parts obstructed, and dissipateth the venom into sweat, or, if nature be too weak, the patient dieth. Monopolies and abuses of publicans. Again, there is sometimes in a commonwealth a disease which resembleth the pleurisy, and that is, when the treasure of the commonwealth, flowing out of its due course, is gathered together in too much abundance in one or a few private men, by monopolies or by farms of the public revenues, in the same manner as the blood in a pleurisy, getting into the membrane of the breast, breedeth there an inflammation, accompanied with a fever and painful stitches. Popular men. Also, the popularity of a potent subject, unless the commonwealth have very good caution of his fidelity, is a dangerous disease, because the people, which should receive their motion from the authority of the sovereign, by the flattery and by the reputation of an ambitious man, are drawn away from their obedience to the laws, to follow a man of whose virtues and designs they have no knowledge. And this is commonly of more danger in a popular government than in a monarchy, because an army is of so great force and multitude as it may easily be made believe they are the people. By this means it was that Julius Caesar, who was set up by the people against the Senate, having won to himself the affections of his army, made himself master both of Senate and people. And this proceeding of popular and ambitious men is plain rebellion, and may be resembled to the effects of witchcraft. Excessive greatness of a town, multitude of corporations, liberty of disputing against sovereign power. Another infirmity of a commonwealth is the immoderate greatness of a town, when it is able to furnish out of its own circuit the number and expense of a great army, as also the great number of corporations, which are, as it were, many lesser commonwealths in the bowels of a greater, like worms in the entrails of a natural man. To which may be added the liberty of disrupting against absolute power by pretenders to political prudence, which, though bred for the most part in the lees of the people, yet animated by false doctrines, are perpetually meddling with the fundamental laws to the molestation of the commonwealth, like the little worms which physicians call Ascarides. We may further add the insatiable appetite of enlarging dominion, with the incurable wounds thereby many times received from the enemy, and the wens of ununited conquests, which are many times a burthen, and with less danger lost than kept, as also the lethargy of ease and consumption of riot and vain expense. Dissolution of the Commonwealth. Lastly, when in a war, foreign or intestine, the enemies get a final victory, so as the forces of the Commonwealth keeping the field no longer, there is no further protection of subjects in their loyalty, then is the Commonwealth dissolved, and every man at liberty to protect himself by such courses as his own discretion shall suggest unto him. For the sovereign is the public soul, giving life and motion to the commonwealth, which expiring the members are governed by it no more than the carcass of a man by his departed, though immortal, soul. For though the right of a sovereign monarch cannot be extinguished by the act of another, yet the obligation of the members may. For he that wants protection may seek it anywhere, and when he hath it, is obliged, without fraudulent pretence of having submitted himself out of fear, to protect his protection as long as he is able. But when the power of an assembly is once suppressed, the right of the same perisheth utterly, because the assembly itself is extinct, and consequently there is no possibility for the sovereignty to re-enter. Chapter 30 Of the Office of the Sovereign Representative. The Procuration of the Good of the People. The office of the sovereign, be it a monarch or an assembly, consisteth in the end for which he was trusted with the sovereign power, namely, the procuration of the safety of the people, to which he is obliged by the law of nature, and to render an account thereof to God, the author of that law, and to none but him. But by safety here is not meant a bare preservation, but also all other contentments of life, which every man by lawful industry, without danger or hurt to the commonwealth, shall acquire to himself. By instruction and laws. And this is intended should be done, not by care applied to individuals, further than their protection from injuries when they shall complain, but by a general providence contained in public instruction, both of doctrine and example, and in the making and executing of good laws to which individual persons may apply their own cases. Against the duty of a sovereign to relinquish any essential right of sovereignty, or not to see the people taught the grounds of them. And because, if the essential rights of sovereignty specified before in the 18th chapter be taken away, the commonwealth is thereby dissolved, and every man returneth into the condition and calamity of a war with every other man, which is the greatest evil that can happen in this life. It is the office of the sovereign to maintain those rights entire, and consequently against his duty, first to transfer to another or to lay from himself any of them, for he that deserteth the means deserteth the ends, and he deserteth the means that, being the sovereign, acknowledgeth himself subject to the civil laws, and renounceth the power of supreme judicature, or of making war or peace by his own authority, or of judging of the necessities of the commonwealth, or of levying money and soldiers when, and as much as in his own conscience he shall judge necessary, or of making officers and ministers both of war and peace, or of appointing teachers and examining what doctrines are conformable or contrary to the defence, peace, and good of the people. Secondly, it is against his duty to let the people be ignorant or misinformed of the grounds and reasons of those his essential rights, because thereby men are easy to be seduced and drawn to resist him when the commonwealth shall require their use and exercise. And the grounds of these rights have the rather need to be diligently and truly taught, because they cannot be maintained by any civil law or terror of legal punishment. For a civil law that shall forbid rebellion, and such is all resistance to the essential rights of the sovereignty, is not, as a civil law, any obligation, but by virtue only of the law of nature, that forbiddeth the violation of faith, which natural obligation, if men know not, they cannot know the right of any law the sovereign maketh. And for the punishment, they take it but for an act of hostility, which when they think they have strength enough, they will endeavour by acts of hostility to avoid. Objection of those that say there are no principles of reason for absolute sovereignty. As I have heard some say, that justice is but a word without substance, and that whatsoever a man can by force or art acquire to himself, not only in the condition of war but also in a commonwealth, is his own, which I have already showed to be false, so there be also that maintain that there are no grounds nor principles of reason to sustain those essential rights which make sovereignty absolute. For if there were, they would have been found out in some place or other, whereas we see there has not hitherto been any commonwealth where those rights have been acknowledged or challenged. Wherein they argue as ill as if the savage people of America should deny there were any grounds or principles of reason so to build a house as to last as long as the materials, because they never yet saw any so well built. Time and industry produce every day new knowledge, and as the art of well-building is derived from principles of reason observed by industrious men that had long studied the nature of materials and the diverse effects of figure and proportion long after mankind began, though poorly, to build, so, long time after men have begun to constitute commonwealths, imperfect and apt to relapse into disorder, there may principles of reason be found out by industrious meditation to make their constitution, accepting by external violence, everlasting. And such are those which I have in this discourse set forth, which, whether they come not into the sight of those that have power to make use of them, or be neglected by them or not, concerneth my particular interests at this day very little. But supposing that these of mine are not such principles of reason, yet I am sure they are principles from authority of Scripture, as I shall make it appear when I shall come to speak of the kingdom of God administered by Moses over the Jews, his peculiar people by covenant. Objection from the incapacity of the vulgar. But they say again that though the principles be right, yet common people are not of capacity enough to be made to understand them. I should be glad that the rich and potent subjects of a kingdom, or those that are accounted the most learned, were no less incapable than they. But all men know that the obstructions to this kind of doctrine proceed not so much from the difficulty of the matter as from the interest of them that are to learn. Potent men digest hardly anything that setteth up a power to bridle their affections, and learned men anything that discovereth their errors, and thereby lesseneth their authority, whereas the common people's minds, unless they be tainted with dependence on the potent, or scribbled over with the opinions of their doctors, are like clean paper, fit to receive whatsoever by public authority shall be imprinted in them. Shall whole nations be brought to acquiesce in the great mysteries of the Christian religion, which are above reason, and millions of men be made believe that the same body may be in innumerable places at one and the same time, which is against reason? And shall not men be able, by their teaching and preaching, protected by the law, to make that received which is so consonant to reason, that any unprejudicated man needs no more to learn it than to hear it? I conclude, therefore, that in the instruction of the people in the essential rights which are the natural and fundamental laws of sovereignty, there is no difficulty, whilst a sovereign has his power entire, but what proceeds from his own fault or the fault of those whom he trusteth in the administration of the commonwealth, and consequently it is his duty to cause them so to be instructed, and not only his duty, but his benefit also, and security against the danger that may arrive to himself in his natural person from rebellion. Subjects are to be taught not to affect change of government. And to descend to particulars, the people are to be taught, first, that they ought not to be in love with any form of government they see in their neighbour nations more than with their own, nor whatsoever present prosperity they behold in nations that are otherwise governed than they, to desire change. For the prosperity of a people ruled by an aristocratical or democratical assembly cometh not from aristocracy nor from democracy, but from the obedience and concord of the subjects, nor do the people flourish in a monarchy because one man has the right to rule them, but because they obey him. Take away in any kind of state the obedience and consequently the concord of the people, and they shall not only not flourish, but in short time be dissolved. And they that go about by disobedience to do no more than reform the commonwealth shall find they do thereby destroy it, like the foolish daughters of Peleus in the fable, which, desiring to renew the youth of their decrepit father, did, by the counsel of Medea, cut him in pieces and boil him, together with strange herbs, but made not of him a new man. This desire of change is like the breach of the first of God's commandments, for there God says, Non habebis Deos alienos, though thou shalt not have the gods of other nations, and in another place concerning kings, that they are gods. nor adhere against the sovereign to popular men. Secondly, they are to be taught that they ought not to be led with admiration of the virtue of any of their fellow subjects, how high soever he stand, or how conspicuously soever he shine in the commonwealth, nor of any assembly except the sovereign assembly, so as to defer to them any obedience or honour appropriate to the sovereign only, whom in their particular stations they represent, nor to receive any influence from them but such as is conveyed by them from the sovereign authority. For that sovereign cannot be imagined to love his people as he ought, that is not jealous of them, but suffers them by the flattery of popular men to be seduced from their loyalty, as they have often been, not only secretly but openly, so as to proclaim marriage with them in facie ecclesi, by preachers, and by publishing the same in the open streets, which may fitly be compared to the violation of the second of the Ten Commandments. Nor to dispute the sovereign power. Thirdly, in consequence to this, they ought to be informed how great a fault it is to speak evil of the sovereign representative, whether one man or an assembly of men, or to argue and dispute his power, or any way to use his name irreverently, whereby he may be brought into contempt with his people and their obedience, in which the safety of the commonwealth consisteth, slackened, which doctrine the third commandment by resemblance pointeth to, and to have days set apart to learn their duty. Fourthly, seeing people cannot be taught this, nor when it is taught remember it, nor after one generation past so much as know in whom the sovereign power is placed, without setting apart from their ordinary labour some certain times in which they may attend those that are appointed to instruct them. It is necessary that some such times be determined, wherein they may assemble together, and after prayers and praises given to God, the sovereign of sovereigns, hear those their duties told them, and the positive laws, such as generally concern them all, read and expounded, and be put in mind of the authority that maketh them laws. To this end had the Jews every seventh day a Sabbath, in which the law was read and expounded, and in the solemnity whereof they were put in mind that their king was God, that having created the world in 6 days, he rested the seventh day, and by their resting on it from their labour, that God was their king, which redeemed them from their servile and painful labour in Egypt, and gave them a time, after they had rejoiced in God, to take joy also in themselves by lawful recreation. So that the first table of the commandments is spent all in setting down the sum of God's absolute power, not only as God, but as king by pact, in peculiar, of the Jews, and may therefore give light to those that have sovereign power conferred on them by the consent of men, to see what doctrine they ought to teach their subjects. And to honour their parents. And because the first instruction of children dependeth on the care of their parents, it is necessary that they should be obedient to them, whilst they are under their tuition. And not only so, but that also afterwards, as gratitude requireth, they acknowledge the benefit of their education by external signs of honour. To which end they are to be taught that originally the father of every man was also his sovereign lord, with power over him of life and death, and that the fathers of families, when by instituting a commonwealth they resigned that absolute power, yet it was never intended they should lose the honour due unto them for their education. For to relinquish such right was not necessary to the institution of sovereign power, nor would there be any reason why any man should desire to have children, or take the care to nourish and instruct them, if they were afterwards to have no other benefit from them than from other men. And this accordeth with the fifth commandment. And to avoid doing of injury. Again, every sovereign ought to cause justice to be taught, which, consisting in taking from no man what is his, is as much as to say to cause men to be taught not to deprive their neighbours, by violence or fraud, of anything which by the sovereign authority is theirs. of things held in propriety, those that are dearest to a man are his own life and limbs, and in the next degree, in most men, those that concern conjugal affection, and after them riches and means of living. Therefore the people are to be taught to abstain from violence to one another's person by private revenges, from violation of conjugal honour, and from forcible rapine and fraudulent surruption of one another's goods. For which purpose also it is necessary they be showed the evil consequences of false judgment, by corruption either of judges or witnesses, whereby the distinction of propriety is taken away, and justice becomes of no effect. All which things are intimated in the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th commandments. And to do all this sincerely from the heart. Lastly, they are to be taught that not only the unjust facts, but the designs and intentions to do them, though by accident hindered, are injustice, which consisteth in the pravity of the will as well as in the irregularity of the act. And this is the intention of the 10th commandment and the sum of the 2nd table, which is reduced all to this one commandment of mutual charity, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself, as the sum of the 1st table is reduced to the love of God, whom they had then newly received as their king. The use of universities. As for the means and conduits by which the people may receive this instruction, we are to search by what means so many opinions, contrary to the peace of mankind, upon weak and false principles, have nevertheless been so deeply rooted in them. I mean those which I have in the precedent chapter specified, as that men shall judge of what is lawful and unlawful, not by the law itself, but by their own consciences. That is to say, by their own private judgments, that subjects sin in obeying the commands of the commonwealth, unless they themselves have first judged them to be lawful, that their propriety and their riches is such as to exclude the dominion which the commonwealth hath over the same, that it is lawful for subjects to kill such as they call tyrants, that the sovereign power may be divided and the like, which come to be instilled into the people by this means. They whom necessity or covetousness keepeth attent on their trades and labour, and they on the other side whom superfluity or sloth carrieth after their sensual pleasures, which two sorts of men take up the greatest part of mankind, being diverted from the deep meditation which the learning of truth, not only in the matter of natural justice, but also of all other sciences necessarily requireth, receive the notions of their duty, chiefly from divines in the pulpit, and partly from such of their neighbours or familiar acquaintance, as having the faculty of discoursing readily and plausibly, seem wiser and better learned in cases of law and conscience than themselves. And the divines, and such others as make show of learning, derive their knowledge from the universities and from the schools of law, or from the books which by men, eminent in those schools and universities, have been published. It is therefore manifest that the instruction of the people dependeth wholly on the right teaching of youth in the universities. But are not, may some man say, the universities of England learned enough already to do that? Or is it you will undertake to teach the universities? Hard questions. Yet to the first I doubt not to answer, that till towards the latter end of Henry VIII the power of the Pope was always upheld against the power of the Commonwealth, principally by the universities, and that the doctrines maintained by so many preachers against the sovereign power of the King and by so many lawyers and others that had their education there is a sufficient argument that though the universities were not authors of those false doctrines, yet they knew not how to plant the true. For in such a contradiction of opinions, it is most certain that they have not been sufficiently instructed. And it is no wonder if they yet retain a relish of that subtle liquor wherewith they were first seasoned against the civil authority. But to the latter question, it is not fit nor needful for me to say either aye or no, for any man that sees what I am doing may easily perceive what I think. The safety of the people requireth further from him all them that have the sovereign power, that justice be equally administered to all degrees of people, that is, that as well the rich and mighty as poor and obscure persons may be righted of the injuries done them, so as the great may have no greater hope of impunity when they do violence, dishonour, or any injury to the meaner sort, than when one of these does the like to one of them. For in this consisteth equity, to which, as being precept of the law of nature, a sovereign is as much subject as any of the meanest of his people. All breaches of the law are offences against the commonwealth, but there be some that are also against private persons. Those that concern the commonwealth only may, without breach of equity, be pardoned, for every man may pardon what is done against himself according to his own discretion. But an offence against a private man cannot in equity be pardoned without the consent of him that is injured or reasonable satisfaction. The inequality of subjects proceedeth from the acts of sovereign power, and therefore has no more place in the presence of the sovereign, that is to say, in a court of justice, than the inequality between kings and their subjects in the presence of the King of Kings. The honour of great persons is to be valued for their beneficence and the aids they give to men of inferior rank, or not at all. And the violences, oppressions, and injuries they do are not extenuated, but aggravated by the greatness of their persons, because they have least need to commit them. The consequences of this partiality towards the great proceed in this manner. Impunity maketh insolence, insolence hatred, and hatred an endeavour to pull down all oppressing and contumelious greatness, through which the ruin of the commonwealth. Equal taxes. To equal justice appertaineth also the equal imposition of taxes, the equality whereof dependeth not on the equality of riches, but on the equality of the debt that every man oweth to the commonwealth for his defence. It is not enough for a man to labour for the maintenance of his life, but also to fight, if need be, for the securing of his labour. They must either do as the Jews did after their return from captivity, in re-edifying the temple, build with one hand and hold the sword in the other, or else they must hire others to fight for them. For the impositions that are laid on the people by the sovereign power are nothing else but the wages due to them that hold the public sword, to defend private men in the exercise of their several trades and callings. Seeing, then, the benefit that every one receiveth thereby is the enjoyment of life, which is equally dear to poor and rich. The debt which a poor man oweth them that defend his life is the same which a rich man oweth for the defence of his, saving that the rich, who have the service of the poor, may be debtors not only for their own persons, but for many more. Which considered, the equality of imposition consisteth rather in the equality of that which is consumed than of the riches of the persons that consume the same. For what reason is there that he which laboureth much, and sparing the fruits of his labour consumeth little, should be more charged than he that living idly getteth little and spendeth all he gets, seeing the one hath no more protection from the commonwealth than the other? But when the impositions are laid upon those things which men consume, every man payeth equally for what he useth, nor is the commonwealth defrauded by the luxurious waste of private men. Public charity. And whereas many men, by accident inevitable, become unable to maintain themselves by their labour, they ought not to be left to the charity of private persons, but to be provided for, as far forth as the necessities of nature require, by the laws of the commonwealth. For as it is uncharitableness in any man to neglect the impotent, so it is in the sovereign of a commonwealth to expose them to the hazard of such uncertain charity. Prevention of idleness. But for such as have strong bodies, the case is otherwise. They are to be forced to work, and to avoid the excuse of not finding employment, there ought to be such laws as may encourage all manner of arts, as navigation, agriculture, fishing, and all manner of manufacture that requires labour. The multitude of poor and yet strong people still increasing, they are to be transplanted into countries not sufficiently inhabited, where nevertheless they are not to exterminate those they find there, but constrain them to inhabit closer together, and not to range a great deal of ground to snatch what they find, but to court each little plot with art and labour, to give them their sustenance in due season. And when all the world is overcharged with inhabitants, then the last remedy of all is war, which provideth for every man by victory or death. Good laws, what? To the care of the sovereign belongeth the making of good laws. But what is a good law? By a good law I mean not a just law, for no law can be unjust. The law is made by the sovereign power, and all that is done by such power is warranted and owned by every one of the people, and that which every man will have so, no man can say is unjust. It is in the laws of a commonwealth, as in the laws of gaming. Whatsoever the gamesters all agree on is injustice to none of them. A good law is that which is needful for the good of the people, and withal perspicuous. Such as are necessary. For the use of laws which are but rules authorized is not to bind the people from all voluntary actions, but to direct and keep them in such a motion as not to hurt themselves by their own impetuous desires, rashness, or indiscretion, as hedges are set not to stop travellers, but to keep them in their way. And therefore a law that is not needful, having not the true end of a law, is not good. A law may be conceived to be good, when it is for the benefit of the sovereign, though it be not necessary for the people, but it is not so. For the good of the sovereign and people cannot be separated. It is a weak sovereign that has weak subjects, and a weak people whose sovereign wanteth power to rule them at his will. Unnecessary laws are not good laws, but traps for money, which, where the right of sovereign power is acknowledged, are superfluous, and where it is not acknowledged, insufficient to defend the people. Such as are perspicuous. The perspicuity consisteth not so much in the words of the law itself, as in a declaration of the causes and motives for which it was made. That is it that shows us the meaning of the legislator, and the meaning of the legislator known, the law is more easily understood by few than many words. For all words are subject to ambiguity, and therefore multiplication of words in the body of the law is multiplication of ambiguity. Besides, it seems to imply by too much diligence that whosoever can evade the words is without the compass of the law. And this is a cause of many unnecessary processes, for when I consider how short were the laws of ancient times, and how they grew by degrees still longer, methinks I see a contention between the penners and pleaders of the law, the former seeking to circumscribe the latter, and the latter to evade their circumscriptions, and that the pleaders have got the victory. It belongeth therefore to the office of a legislator, such as is in all commonwealths the supreme representative, be it one man or an assembly, to make the reason perspicuous, why the law was made, and the body of the law itself as short, but in as proper and significant terms as may be. Punishments. It belongeth also to the office of the sovereign to make a right application of punishments and rewards, and seeing the end of punishing is not revenge and discharge of choler, but correction either of the offender or of others by his example. The severest punishments are to be inflicted for those crimes that are of most danger to the public, such as are those which proceed from malice to the government established, those that spring from contempt of justice, those that provoke indignation in the multitude, and those which unpunished seem authorized, as when they are committed by sons, servants, or favorites of men in authority. For indignation carrieth men not only against the actors and authors of injustice, but against all power that is likely to protect them, as in the case of Tarquin, when for the insolent act of one of his sons he was driven out of Rome and the monarchy itself dissolved. but crimes of infirmity, such as are those which proceed from great provocation, from great fear, great need, or from ignorance, whether the fact be a great crime or not, there is place many times for lenity, without prejudice to the commonwealth, and lenity, when there is such place for it, is required by the law of nature. The punishment of the leaders and teachers in a commotion, not the poor seduced people, when they are punished, can profit the commonwealth by their example. To be severe to the people is to punish that ignorance which may in great part be imputed to the sovereign whose fault it was that they were no better instructed. Rewards. In like manner it belongeth to the office and duty of the sovereign to apply his rewards always so, as there may arise from them benefit to the commonwealth, wherein consisteth their use and end, and is then done, when they that have well served the commonwealth are, with as little expense of the common treasure as is possible, so well recompensed, as others thereby may be encouraged, both to serve the same as faithfully as they can, and to study the arts by which they may be enabled to do it better. To buy with money or preferment from a popular ambitious subject, to be quiet and desist from making ill impressions in the minds of the people, has nothing of the nature of reward, which is ordained not for disservice, but for service past, nor a sign of gratitude, but of fear, nor does it tend to the benefit, but to the damage of the public. It is a contention with ambition, like that of Hercules with the monster Hydra, which having many heads for every one that was vanquished, there grew up three. For in like manner, when the stubbornness of one popular man is overcome with reward, there arise many more by the example that do the same mischief in hope of like benefit. And as all sorts of manufacture, so also malice increaseth by being vendible. And though sometimes a civil war may be deferred by such ways as that, yet the danger grows still the greater, and the public ruin more assured. It is therefore against the duty of the sovereign, to whom the public safety is committed, to reward those that aspire to greatness by disturbing the peace of their country, and not rather to oppose the beginnings of such men with a little danger than after a longer time with greater. Counsellors. Another business of the sovereign is to choose good counsellors, I mean such whose advice he is to take in the government of the commonwealth. For this word counsel, consilium, corrupted from considium, is of a large signification, and comprehendeth all assemblies of men that sit together, not only to deliberate what is to be done hereafter, but also to judge of facts past and of law for the present. I take it here in the first sense only, and in this sense there is no choice of counsel, neither in a democracy nor aristocracy, because the persons counselling are members of the person counselled. The choice of counsellors, therefore, is proper to monarchy, in which the sovereign that endeavoureth not to make choice of those that in every kind are the most able, dischargeth not his office as he ought to do. The most able counsellors are they that have least hope of benefit by giving evil counsel, and most knowledge of those things that conduce to the peace and defence of the commonwealth. It is a hard matter to know who expecteth benefit from public troubles, but the signs that guide to a just suspicion is the soothing of the people in their unreasonable or irremediable grievances by men whose estates are not sufficient to discharge their accustomed expenses, and may easily be observed by anyone whom it concerns to know it. But to know who has most knowledge of the public affairs is yet harder, and they that know them need them a great deal the less. For to know who knows the rules almost of any art is a great degree of the knowledge of the same art, because no man can be assured of the truth of another's rules, but he that is first taught to understand them. But the best signs of knowledge of any art are much conversing in it and constant good effects of it. Good counsel comes not by lot nor by inheritance, and therefore there is no more reason to expect good advice from the rich or noble in matter of state than in delineating the dimensions of a fortress, unless we shall think there needs no method in the study of the politics, as there does in the study of geometry, but only to be lookers-on, which is not so. For the politics is the harder study of the two, whereas in these parts of Europe it hath been taken for a right of certain persons to have place in the highest council of state by inheritance. It is derived from the conquests of the ancient Germans, wherein many absolute lords, joining together to conquer other nations, would not enter into the confederacy without such privileges as might be marks of difference in time following between